okay.
Hello, I think everything's fine, thank you.
It's on the projectors on blank, so
I need to... Where do I switch it on? Oh, behind here. Oh.
Everything's working.
How do I switch on the... Oh.
That's on there.
And PC is already...
Yeah.
Okay. Seems to be still okay.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Okay, good morning everyone. Today will be the first lecture on robotics, the second part of the talk. Bob will be back next week and will talk about the connection between vision and robotics, and so it might be a good idea to start a little bit already with the general idea of robotics. So we will talk mainly today about the question how a robot interacts with the environment, what is important about such interactions, and maybe to start with what is a robot in the first place. And we will give some kind of overview over the robotics part of this course. So there is this concept of affordances, which actually will be more important in the next lecture on Friday, which is meant to express some kind of a natural relation between perceptual qualities, for example, information which you can obtain by vision, and actions which are appropriate in this situation. So just consider this task. A robot has to do some steps, and in order to be able to calculate its walking strategy, it might be a good idea to have a prediction on the flatness of the ground at the point where the next footstep is to be taken. And so a typical, what is considered here a traditional approach would be to scan the scene, to extract general contours and edges. From these ones you can reconstruct regions. Some of the regions have a certain surface which is filled into this region. These surfaces need to be analyzed with respect to their inclination towards the robot and towards maybe some kind of absolute world coordinates. And finally, it's to be decided whether near the expected impact point of the foot is really some kind of horizontal region in this all the surfaces in the environment of the robot. So that's the standard procedure which needs to be taken in some cases, but for this particular point of walking, it might not really be necessary to process all the scene, and instead it might be nice to have this kind of flat surface near feet detector some kind of a distance measurement from the foot, which is subtract a number of different reflected ultrasound waves, for example, or laser measurements, which just give some kind of a very local and very much adapted information, which is especially needed in this particular situation. And the question is whether this kind of very striking difference in complexity between the two approaches which are outlined here, whether this can be translated into a general type of interaction between sensing and action. So we know that action, in order to be meaningful, needs to be guided by sensory information. So this might be information which is at the moment present or which has been acquired before and which is processed in a certain way in the meantime. But on the other hand, of course, whether any bit of sensory information is relevant is, of course, also determined by the action, or maybe in generalization of this, by the importance of a certain action. And in this way, it's always important to consider these two aspects which have been there's a quotation that these two aspects form the two ends of a broken stick, and in robotics it's not so much important just to translate from sensory information to information which is needed to control the actuators of the robot, but also to get this idea what kind of action will be requiring what sensor information, or what kind of changes in the sensory information are actually produced by the action of the robot itself. And so this kind of two-way dependency between action and sensing, so once inside the robot via the robot control and once outside the robot through the environment, so that's so to say the underlying theme, and I hope we have a chance to return to this as often as possible. But for today, I think we will just go through certain aspects of what actions robots can take. And just to start with, we maybe should ask this kind of question, typical exam question after this course. Of course, robots are just phenomenologically appearing in all kinds of different shapes and disguises, and not everything what looks like a robot might be a robot. Think of all kinds of science fiction movies. On the other hand, there are lots of robots present which may not even fit this definition. So if you talk about the robot as a mechanical artificial agent, there are at least experimentally robots which are of a size where maybe not mechanics in the sense of physics plays a role, but where more quantum theory is the right way to describe it. But they still have characteristics of the robot, may perhaps not in the full sense of the word, but it's clear that this physics of robots will also be adapted. There will be, or there are ideas about constructing robots from biological materials, where you would rather say a biological artificial agent or something like this. But it's an artificial agent, which leaves us with the question, what is an agent? Agent is simply a system which is able to produce by itself certain actions. This is maybe not too clear. At least, for example, philosophers like Aristotle had the opinion that there's no way, now everything has to have a cause, and in a robot, the course of behavior should be maybe your program that you have put into the robot in the beginning, but once the robot is started, yeah, it will satisfy this definition of an agent in the sense that everything what the robot is doing just comes out of itself. It is usually realized by some kind of electromechanical device, which is presently the standard, but might not really be in future the general trend in the field. Anyway, what you always have to have is this kind of two-way connections to the external world. There's a possibility to obtain information, and there's a possibility to really physically interact with the environment, which can be in the mechanics or might be also in this kind of backward direction that in camera is to be positioned, which also has not directly an effect on the external world, but on the way how the external world is perceived. And of course, there might be symbolic actions which have a physical meaning, but not in the sense as to change the environment in a certain way, but in order to have maybe an exchange of information as an essential mechanism of this part of action, exchange of information with other agents or other robots, for example. Of course, in between, there should be this kind of intelligence component in the robot, which is qualified by its complexity, because there are different modules taking care of different aspects of the function of the robot, for example, a vision module and an intermediate control module, and there are maybe higher modules which supervise different types of controls in the robot and so on. On the other hand, of course, we would like to have this phenomenological view on a robot, so if the robot behaves in an appropriate way or perhaps only in a particularly playful and a nice way, we would also admit that ascribe intelligence to the robot. Whether it's produced by chance, maybe, or by some kind of clever design is not really important for this phenomenological view on a robot. So this is usually what you are able to do, to program some complex structure. And people working in robotics are very much aware of this, that of course, we need much better programs for robots, which is obvious if you have to interact with a robot in a certain way. But most of the limitations actually arrive from these problems with acting and sensing. And so these are usually not the parts of in robotics where you can do much about, but these are the parts which are crucial in order to have the information which the intelligence component can actually work with later on. So just in a completely analogous way, a robot can be cut into pieces and we will be left with sensory components, some kind of internal information processing modules, and actuatory components. Of course, there are lots of other things in a robot which are not really classifiable in this way, like batteries or communication to some extent might be actuation, and of course different types of tools inside the robot for making sure that the different parts of the robot interacting in a meaningful way. Of course, there might be also the need for having the possibility to inspect the inner life of the robot if you want to improve its function. And now we will just go through these different parts. The sensory systems can be classified into three different aspects of with respect to the information that is sensed. So there might, of course, be the most important part, what can be learned about the external world, what kind of objects are out there. Yeah. Another important question is proprioception. So for example, a robot needs to know what kind of movement it is doing. It needs to know whether it's upright, for example. It needs to know whether the temperature is in a reasonable range, things like this. And of course, there's also this kind of combination of the two. So for example, by knowing that my angle didn't change as I desired, I can get some kind of information about an object outside. Yeah, so it's not really a direct perception of the robot, of the object, but it's an inference which I can do from the proprioceptive sensors about some kind of interfering course from outside. So inside the robot, ideally it should really look like inside our brain, although we may not really know all the details of our brain. We have some kind of idea how the main components of the brain are working. There are lots of different input streams which do some kind of pre-processing of sensory signals to improve, for example, contrast or improve reliability of the incoming signals by making prediction about future information. There will be some kind of memory which has different aspects to know what things are, to know what really happened to the robot. Could be this episodic memory, or to know really how to name things in order to be able to talk to other or to communicate with other agents. There need to be some kind of rules how these components can be changed, so what kind of information is important enough in order to be stored in the memory. And there need to be some kind of workspace where combinations among these stored and presently arriving informations can be carried out, which is analogous to a human working memory and which is important for planning and decision making in the robot. And finally, of course, after all these decisions have been made, it's important to transfer them in a way that is understandable for the actuatory components of the robot, whereas that really that what is intended also is realized in the real world in spite of all the noise and possible resistances. So that's done by a control component. So this can be, in some cases, very, very simple. Here's a genuine robot, which is meant to form some kind of a biological model. It's replicating some kind of fossils, so we can maybe assume that these creatures which created this spiral-like patterns were maybe not more complicated than this one. So it combines two different behavioral strategies with some very simple sensors. So there are these light sensors here which like to see something light in front, and the other one likes to see something dark. And so if the machine here, the car turns in the wrong direction, it either will lose this part here or it will receive information that there is some kind of light underground here, and it will move away. So it remains always parallel to the previous traces. It has to be initialized, of course, in some way. And it processes sensory information, and if there is some kind of deviation on either side, it will just correct its action. It will just move slightly in a different angle and produces this beautiful pattern here in this case. Because there is this tight or hopefully tight interaction with between action and perception, it's maybe reasonable also to classify actuatory components in the same way as the sensory components. So there are some kind of outside directed actions like whatever, scratching myself, or for a robot this could be what could this be for a robot to the own body? Maybe some kind of actions which are important to keep balance, or actions relating to perception, moving cameras into different directions, or of course production of sounds or other types of communication. So these effectors can be of all different shapes, and usually you take inspiration from biology. Here's a particularly nice example, which was, I think, suggested last year. You know this from the supermarket. If you touch these packages of grounded coffee, they are completely hard. Yeah? And as soon as you stick a needle inside, they become very soft. And this principle was used here. You take an air balloon, put some kind of ground coffee. It's really coffee, yeah, inside. And so in the standard form, you can just adapt the shape of this actuator to the shape of a certain object here. then you suck the air out, and this freezes this shape. And by this rubber surface, you get sufficient grip in order to move really all kinds of different objects without really to think much how to place fingers and how much pressure to apply to certain fingers. So in some cases, this kind of non-biological ideas as well. Now maybe that's not exactly non-biological, because probably we'll find similar principles also in biology. But creative novel ideas can be very helpful and replace a lot of computational effort in robots. Of course, this will not solve all the problems. There are other points which are to be observed. So for example, this system has essentially just one action it can do, either take out the air or maybe release this air again into the vacuum. But usually we need more degrees of freedom. I will just continue with this concept in a second. We will maybe have to study methods of locomotion, which are also very various in robotics. There is the possibility of other types of manipulators as this one, and of course internal mechanisms, maybe to transfer energy from one part of the robot to another one. So for example, like our muscles in the finger movings are situated somewhere in the lower arm, and we need to have some possibilities to generate the required torque at the position where it's necessary. So any action which is to be performed by the robot at some point really there's this kind of boundary between the robot and the external world, and this boundary is where the effector is actually lying. Effectors are in most of the maybe research projects in robots are often inspired by biology, so that's why you find all kinds of legs or fins, maybe even claws for climbing robots that we have seen in the first lecture. Or maybe the robot also uses just the body as in the type of a snake or caterpillar in order to produce some propulsion in a certain direction. If it's more directly interacting with objects in the environment, then it will maybe be in be determined by the task. It can maybe have some particular job to do, and will be equipped with tools in order to do this job. It might as well also use not particular actuators or effectors, but just the whole body by pushing boxes around. In both cases, however, the basic quantity underlying to this is this idea of decrease of freedom, and I think we should discuss this a little bit more. So there are different aspects of decrease of freedom. So the first one is, of course, if you design a robot, what kind of task space you have. So for example, an airplane, you could at least think of six different degrees of freedom which uniquely determine the state of an airplane. Of course, it can be anywhere in the three-dimensional space, so in a two-dimensional surface of the Earth plus the height of the airplane. And in addition to these three spatial, you have also three rotational degrees of freedom. So in a certain position, the airplane might have different angles in the horizontal direction. It might be turned with respect to this roll axis, or also with respect to the pitch axis, which tells whether it's rising or sinking. However, if you are a pilot of an airplane, you will not really be able to control all the degrees of freedom in the same way. So especially, so you can go up and down and you can turn, but you will not really be able to move to either side. This doesn't really mean that this particular point is not reachable by the airplane. So the airplane would have to take a detour and then it could come back, but it's not really that there's an action to move over here. So in a sense, the pilot has only 2 degrees of freedom. Yeah, can either go up, down, left, right. I mean, you can do all kinds. Or the pilot can do all kinds of things. But so in this level of description, there are just two possibilities for this. But just by combination of these 2 degrees of freedom, you can reach all the 6 dimensions of a spatial setup of the airplane in this case. So if you have a robot on a plane, what would be the relation between the task or task implied degrees of freedom and the controllable degrees of freedom? Any suggestions? Too early in the morning. Obviously, in a plane, yeah, you have 3 degrees of freedom. You can be in 2 spatial directions, and you have 2 spatial coordinates. And in addition, you have an angle for this. You can. I'm sorry, there's something wrong with the airplane. Of course, there are 3 degrees of freedom. You can also accelerate in the forward direction, sorry. And in the plane, of course, you can turn with respect to 1 angle, and you can also accelerate in the forward direction. So we are missing 1 degree of freedom in the plane and 3 degrees of freedom in the spatial situation. And you cannot just move sidewards usually. If it's a car, you can, by some kind of maneuvers, you can compensate for this. This is some kind of an method automatry, how to deal with these spatial situations in the 2-dimensional, but as well, of course, by generalization also in the 3-dimensional setting, that you have these 3 coordinates which determine the current position and the current bearing of the robot. And the idea is, can you use this information in order to make predictions to the future? So you just take what you believe to be at the moment, so you need some kind of starting position, and you add the change in position which is due to the commanded motion. Of course, if you do this just from what you want to happen, there might be some kind of errors. Of course, you can calibrate this maybe in order to avoid some kind of systematic errors in this one, but there's always some kind of different problems. So if your commanded motion is move forward for 1 second, maybe this timing might be inaccurate, or you might not exactly go forward, which lead to other errors. So it's maybe a good idea to look what really happened at the level of the motors. And of course, it can happen that the wheel just slip on the surface, or that the terrain is uneven. So it will not really be possible just to use the simple formula. And you might have to rely on GPS or some landmarks in order to correct now and then your estimate of the position. In a robot, of course, in addition to this degree of freedom, which is implied by the task or which is actually controllable, there might be much more moving parts. So there's, for example, this scissors lift, which has this kind of structure, but it has essentially only 1 degree of freedom, can only hopefully only go up and down, but it has lots of joints, arbitrarily many actually. So there is, of course, a difference between these parts. What is important, so in this scissors lift, you only change the distance between the lowest 2 points, or maybe between the 2 highest ones, and this is the only controllable in a degree of freedom. And of course, it's also important how these relate to the task of the robot, and how the robot is actually described in this parameter space. So to answer these questions, usually there is this, especially in this scissors lift, or for example in the parallel manipulator, I think we have seen this in the first lecture, there is linkage between different movable parts, such that the actual degrees of freedom might be less than these. The question is more how many of these ones are controllable. So think, for example, of in Edinburgh, you always like to think of the tram. Yeah? In the tram, in principle, yeah, you can just have a single degree of freedom. We just can go forward or backward. Also, maybe the tram itself has different wheels which might be controllable independently, but which are obviously linked either by some kind of mechanical parts or by some kind of control algorithm which makes sure that the left wheel is moving in the same way as in the right way. So it has lots of moving parts, but they are constrained in such a way that there's only one degree of freedom left. And so in this way, you talk about redundant robots. You can also ask maybe how many degrees of freedom you have in a human arm, not counting the finger movements. Three? So there are three joints, but the joints are actually quite complex. Yeah. So for example, shoulder movements, you can move it up, down, you can move it in the horizontal plane, and you can also turn it in this way. So it's in this way you would say there are three degrees of freedom. Elbow is just a single degree of freedom, and for the wrist you can do these movements and these. So in, you could say that there are, and you can turn. Yeah? So there are seven. Some people, because you can also, in, especially in upper movements, you are using also some other parts of the shoulder. You maybe have even eight movements. For fingers, it depends a little bit how you count it, because it's not so clear whether you have three or two degrees of. So some people can really use more than 2 degrees of freedom in this plane of the finger. Of course, you can also move in this way. So it's something like 22 or 24 for all the fingers, which is quite a lot, yeah, because this is a 22-dimensional space which you have to, where you have to specify a point if you want to make some kind of control. An octopus, it's maybe large in the sense that theoretically, there are infinitely many degrees of freedom in an octopus arm. But what octopuses actually do in order to deal with these complex control problems is to form at a particular point something like an elbow. You know? So the task is to get the fish and to put it to the mouth. And what the octopuses do is they don't really calculate all the actions which they need for all the many degrees of freedom, but they propagate some activity from the sensation of the fish and maybe from the visual system which has seen the fish. And these waves of activity meet at some point, and at this point you form a joint. So if this is roughly halfway, then the control task is much easier. You know, if you have two stiff parts, you just have to decrease the angle at this position. So in addition, we can or have asked already whether these degrees of mobility inside and or let's say the task to be precise, the task decrease of freedom might not really be accessible in a direct way. And if this is the case, then we speak of an holonomic robot, but these cars or planes, they are non-holonomic in the sense that by direct movements you cannot really access all the degrees of freedom of the robot. So we have here is just again this example for the 2D robot. There are possibilities here to have, for this angular degree, just a single wheel or maybe two wheels which determine this, or like in these Capera robots which you will be using next week, there are two wheels, and by the difference of the speeds of the wheel you can control the angle of the robot, and by the sum of the speeds you have a second a component of the mobility of the robot or of the controllable degrees of freedom in the forward direction. You can also think of other designs here in this way where all the wheels are turnable, or these omni wheels where you have 2 degrees of freedom in each wheel that by certain differences between the wheels you can, you need at least 3 wheels in these cases, you can really steer the robot in a holonomic way across the plane, which often, for example, in robot soccer, this can have some kind of advantages if you are really able to move directly to the ball rather than to have to wait for some kind of maneuver until you are back at the wall. But for example, in robot soccer, there is an additional problem. That's also why the human arm has not just 6 degrees of freedom, as would be sufficient to reach every position and bearing in space. There are maybe some kind of obstacles. So as soon as you want to reach behind something, then you need some additional degrees of freedom. So especially also in robot soccer, if you might not, it might not be enough to go to every position and bearing. In some cases, you need to go around the ball or an opponent, and then you still need to maneuver and to. So the task might require more than the coordinate implied degrees of freedom in the system. Now, of course, in uneven terrains, there might be lots of other degrees of freedom. You might not really use these wheels. Tracks or possibly legs might be an alternative. Here is in this Mars rover some kind of combination. So there is a possibility to change the height of the wheels in a different way. And on the other hand, also to use this efficiency of rotary movement in the wheels. Legs are, of course, quite interesting in this context. But are not too. So the control is quite difficult in these cases, and either you go to this very simple designs. So that's what you probably can also get for very little money in a toy store. This Ampler here, which has 6 legs in these cases. So you always have 3 legs, which provide a stable positioning on the ground, and 3 more legs which can be used to change the position of the robot. So insects often are using this type of gate that you, at each point in time, you have a stable position and you just switch to another stable position and then you reposition the legs in order to get again another one. So in this sense, you might be very safe, and the control problem is quite manageable, but it's difficult, of course, to reach higher speeds in this case, because you always have this kind of quasi-resting position with respect to the legs. The other possibility is to introduce more instability in the system. So this was not really meant to be a method of locomotion, but a first attempt to solve the stability problem, which, for example, bipedal animals have been able to solve. So what humans are doing is that we, on purpose, so to say, move to a very unstable state while walking. If you just have a single leg on the ground, it's more a kind of falling than actually standing. But we make sure that if we fall just to a position where the other leg can be placed. So we are essentially switching between 2 unstable states at each side. And here in this case, it's just a single unstable state by the single leg. And you need to make sure, in a very similar way as you can balance a pole on your fingertip, the robot is balanced by reducing all kinds of deviations from the vertical line as soon as possible when they are still small and controllable with little effort. And so it took some time before this was actually achieved, this unstable control, which makes leg locomotion interesting. Well, you can get to reasonable efficiencies and speeds at the same time. And today you have probably seen this video of Asimo falling down the stairs. We cannot really say that this problem is solved, yeah, but at least there's some reasonable progress to really have walking and running robots, which are still moving, using some kind of stability principle, so this zero movement point control, meaning that the robot has to make sure if it has a certain surface of the foot that the center of mass of the robot is always exactly vertically above this particular surface. It should not leave the surface of the foot. And if you use the other foot, then this is, so to say, the goal state to move the center of mass from being on top of one foot to being on top of the other foot. And this kind of principle, at least if you have large enough legs or foot diameters, works quite well, at least as something which, as an expression, what needs to be done in this control problem. Now, so this nice animal was meant to be a kind of cat or so. Used in a similar principle, having these two legs on the ground in such a design is also a kind of unstable situation. And this robot in this way could really achieve sufficient speeds, just making sure that the cycle of moving the legs one after the other remains stable. Not too much to stabilize a certain position, but to really stabilize this interchange between the legs. Here are maybe some other possibilities. Again, in this spirit of an affordance, so to say, I will show maybe a video another time of this one here, the possibility of having this type of a purely passive walking machine. And interestingly, these completely passive machines were there before the control problem was actually solvable. So you just give in, so to say, to the complexities of the control, and you say, if I build some kind of a frame with some movable parts, so here are two legs inside and two legs outside, and you put it on an inclined slope, then it just walks. Yeah? If you make sure that the mass distribution and some kind of details of the shape of the feet are chosen correctly and without any kind of motors or control problem. On the other hand, here in Scotland, in the University of Stirling, this cute robot, just this size, was built. And it was the fastest robot in the world, not with respect to absolute speed, but with respect to length of legs. And it has some very simple way of solving this control problem. Yeah? So as soon as you touch the ground with one of the feet, then you send an impulse to the hip of the other leg to make it lift up. With a certain delay, and this is enough to run the robot. If you adjust these delays and maybe the strength of the impact correctly, and so these authors have used a genetic algorithm to optimize these quantities, and suddenly they had the fastest robot in the world. The design of these two robots is actually very simple. You just use this passive dynamics. The legs are made in such a way that their natural frequency is identical to the frequencies that actually can be achieved during walking. Now, of course, if you go to more challenging applications like military, as in this case here, you can invest some more intelligence in these interaction between principles. So, of course, you have also some kind of very clever and biologically inspired design in the robots, but in addition with different types of active stabilization mechanisms, which use information from ground contact, of course, as the most important source of information, but also from information about the bearing. harder to interpret, but maybe for humans and possibly also for these animals of increasing, for humans of important and for robots of increasing importance is to use visual systems to extract the horizon, for example, from an image. Now, of course, there are all kinds of mixtures. Once you are able to deal with legs and with wheels, then maybe you can think of possibilities how to change it. Either you can change it more in this biologically realistic way. Here, so these are more like insect wheels, legs, of course. And here, there is what is called VEX in the R-HEX robot, which actually doesn't have six legs. Does it have? Oh, it has some kind of legs also in between, so it can also run on in a different orientation. And you have three legs mounted in a wheel fashion, so it has this kind of ability to deal with uneven terrain. And on the other hand, you can use motors in a way which are very helpful for, are very efficient in this rotary movements. And of course, you have this spring-like behavior, which reduces the impact of each step and also returns this energy at a later stage. Yeah, and there are, I mean, very impressive different types of locomotion. So in fish robots today, you cannot often, not, if you are not really a fisherman, yeah, you are not, it's not so easy to decide whether it's a real or a robotic fish. In the micromechanical flying robots, you will be able to decide about this. But it's still very impressive to have robots of this size, which can really use this nonlinear dynamics of the airflow in order to keep themselves up in the air, yeah? Or maybe these different types of body movements. In robot arms, the decision about because the freedom is maybe a little bit more complicated, yeah. So you would like to go to six dimensions, while in legs it's often determined by the, or in wheels determined by the surface. So the development is essentially to come as close to a human arm as possible. With this kind of combination of strength in some parts and this very precise movements of the end effector, which is usually a big problem. Of course, you can achieve this, but if you want to achieve this also at low weight and as fast response times, compliance with respect to external perturbances, then it becomes really a challenge. Different types of shapes of the actuators are typically implied by the task, and in this way it's quite obvious whether you should use vacuum cup, yeah, in order to have some kind of large objects lifted, or whether you should have an drilling machine if you have the task of these ones. The more of a problem is if you want to deal with various purposes, so how to combine different tasks into a single manipulator. And so that's why, because biology has given us these hands which can do a lot of things which we on the other hand also consider to be important, hands in robots are some kind of an most interesting discussion. Yeah, they are not really as developed as human hands, so for example, if you are in need of a prosthesis, you will have to live with much less functionality than you are maybe used to, but on the other hand, there are some kind of quite impressive abilities to repeat this handshake here in a way which is appropriate. For example, just measuring the force of the opponent and to press in a way that this feels comfortable for the opponent. It's always this in this compromise between weight, force and precision, you have usually some kind of restriction of choices of the actuations. You cannot place large electric motors on the fingers, for example. And so there might be a possibility to use instead hydraulics or pneumatics, where you can produce the force for the movement at a different place than where it's actually used. And but in many robotic applications, of course, by a good placement of motors, for example, placement of the motors directly at the joints, you can also have a reasonable performance or ratio between effect and required force for this particular effect. If you want to decide about an actuator, you will need to consider lots of different aspects. So, what are the requirements by the task, and what kind of compromises you have to make with respect to, for example, to reliability or energy consumption, as well as maybe the price of the materials in this form. We will talk about control problems of these robot arms especially, but also in general, in the lectures in November. And it will be really be some kind of illustration of the complexity of this task. So from the position in task space to the actually motor command, so the voltage which is sent to a robot. So we will have to deal with these different transformations and how to be able to control them. So that's more or less what I wanted to say today. So what is important again is this problem that robots actually deal with the real world, that they may be, it might be necessary to deal with unforeseeable perturbations to regulate their effects in such a way that the robot is still able to do its task. An important question is how many degrees of freedom are in the task, in the robot, and in the strategy of the robot, and you should have some kind of ideas that control is not an easy problem, and it will be necessary to deal a little bit more with it. Thank you very much for today. Yeah.
It's not this kind of optimization task where the fitness increases and then you reach some kind of global optimum if you're lucky. But it's this kind of interaction. The fitness function actually changes. If you have to play against good actors, then the your fitness is suddenly lower. Then if you have to play the same string or the same strategy, if you play against poor guys.
So I shouldn't be so worried that it doesn't...
And that's the idea that, of course, the fitness changes and consequently, of course, because the single agent also wants to improve or is selected if it improves the fitness and also the agent changes. And there's this kind of ongoing evolution.
Yeah, I also tried to...
That's more like biology, that's why I thought it's more interesting. It's just going up.
So I shouldn't be that worried.